Hello, I'm Keith and the girls, Keith Malley.
I'm Chemda.
Welcome to My Opening Line. We're talking to artists about what got them into their business.
And why, after they failed the first time, do they keep going?
I mean, when it's art, it's going to take some struggle, whether you're a comedian, a filmmaker, an actor. You know, it's disaster. And the world is telling you, don't go for these pipe dreams.
It's embarrassing.
And these people, they go for it anyway. So what got them over their humps? That's what we talk about. First of all, let me say this. Subscribe to the free app Laughable, where you subscribe to podcasts. Yeah, sure. Duh. You know how to do that. But you can also subscribe to a person. If you subscribe to, I don't know, the Keith and the Girl producer, Andrea Allen, and you type in her name, you see every time she's on Keith and the Girl, yeah, but any other podcast at all.
And obviously she hosts a show, so you'll get the Hot Mess Comedy Hour, but if she guests on Keith and the Girl, My Opening Line, The Good, the Dad, and the Ugly, she guests a lot, and she yappity yap yaps about very intimate things. So follow her, follow us on Laughable.
Laughable.com, available for all devices. Ladies and gentlemen, today's guest, host of the Hot Mess Comedy Hour, producer of Keith and the Girl, Andrea Allen. Hello, Andrea.
Honored to be here amongst the Hall of Famers. This is a big fucking deal. Thank you for having me.
You're a big fucking deal.
Ooh, am I? I don't think so.
I've seen your stand. Well, thanks for coming. I've seen your
stand. I'm a fraud.
I think your stand-up's fantastic. Your new album is out right now, as a matter of fact. It's called Gonzo.
Yes.
And could your parents disown you? Sure, sure. Are they millionaires and you're really blowing it? Okay, but it's about the art, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Now, you began stand-up 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. You came to New York 12 years ago.
Yes.
Now, from Canada. Mm-hmm. Everybody says how wonderful and beautiful Canada is. And when they tell me this, they're across from me in America.
This is now the deportation show.
But that's it. What is it? Is it that, you know, when it comes to whether, what school did you go to? Why did you come to America?
I came to America to pursue fashion, to be in the fashion industry. I wasn't sure like what capacity I wanted to be involved because I wasn't like a, you know, I couldn't do good drawings or sketches. I didn't want to be a designer, but I liked the business. And their Parsons New School for Design is probably one of the top, if not the top design schools in the country. And so
New York's up there. When you see, I don't know anything about fashion, but when you see a store that is so that only has one pair of pants in the middle of 6,000 square feet. You see five cities, and New York is one of them. Right?
Always, yeah. It was actually in between New York and London, and I applied
to Paris. That just seems to be where people...
They don't have a school really there that has the reputation that both those cities do. Mm-hmm. Like New York has Parsons School of Design, which is where I went, and then London has Central St. Martin's, and they're known in the fashion world as the top two schools. So I applied to both. Got into both.
Oh.
That's a hell of a commute back and forth between.
And then, well, Parsons gave me a scholarship. So,
okay.
And also, I had been, New York is in North America. And although it was a huge leap, it still felt like a little bit more, you know, manageable because I could get home within like 6 hours or something like
what
that.
What city are you from?
Vancouver.
Okay.
Yeah.
How often do you go back?
Like once a year, maybe twice a year. Depends.
Okay. Yeah. Did you graduate?
Yeah.
And then you got a job based in that, obviously.
Yes, yeah.
And what says, hey, I'm over this. I'm going to go into stand-up.
Well, I guess it was, I kind of like had sort of like two lives going because fashion was something that I was always very interested in. But the people within the industry were so different than, and then there was comedy and like, and I was obsessed with your podcast and you guys, and I kind of hung out in the world of comedy.
Through Keith and the Girl.
Through Keith and the Girl, yeah. And
when did you start listening to Keith and the Girl?
I think I was like 14.
That is
maybe
wrong.
Maybe 15, something like that, yeah.
Very wrong. Did it get in your, but like, if you had a kid, is that a good idea?
It's a terrible idea.
What was like, oh shit, this is what comedy is? Like, this is okay to say?
I think what I liked about your guys' show was this felt like a real conversation. Like, and everywhere in my life, there weren't like, things were not as they seemed. And you two were very, very open about everything that was happening. So it was very attractive to me. I was like, oh my God, this is like people who are actually saying some shit.
And fashion's not really like that.
No, fashion's all about like image and sort of like showing your superiority to others and not...
Even the walk is better than mine.
Sure, yeah. It's vulnerability is not celebrated. It's like a very, very pretentious industry. And I'm not a pretentious person. So while I enjoy like the beauty of the art form, I just never fit in. I was the dumpy person.
I love this. And I know we're going to get into your comedy career, but some of your fashion stuff is so interesting because when you step into comedy, you're like this icon fashion person. You know what I mean? People are like, oh yeah, Andrea fashion in comedy.
The queen amongst the tramps.
Yes, yeah. And then, but when you talk about when you were in fashion, when you were in the office where you were considered big.
Like a big schlub.
Yeah.
And fat.
People would watch you eat.
Yeah. Well, because they were so fucking hungry. It was like, It was like porn. It was like watching someone be not self-conscious about the fact that they're eating like a sandwich or pizza.
Models would pass out in the office on the regular. Right?
Yeah.
They would watch you eat the way a non-smoker deliberately walks into smoke.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love this that you, it was so, and I don't love it, but it was so common for models to come in and faint that you guys had a couple of things ready for them.
Ginger ale, saltine crackers, because ginger ale has sugar in it, so it'll boost their blood sugar, but it's not like it is a carb, but it's like minimal amount of sugar that'll bring them back up, but they won't be upset. And I'm not being condescending about them. They're being force fed, for lack of a better word, these things and crackers, because again, like it's food, but just enough to like get the engine running again, not enough for them to be.
And I think, I don't think that we really put that together, that that's real on a daily basis with fashion. When you said the Devil Wears Prada is the closest.
It's so accurate. Ugh. It's accurate in that, like,
you've never seen that, did you, Keith?
I will now.
Yeah, people, there's like currency in being mean in fashion. Like, you have to be the, what I realized throughout my time there, like, I worked with several young designers and I was always like, I will do the best job. I will stay after work and make sure everything is done. I'll kill myself to be good at this. But I was always very, like, kind and generous with other people. And that's perceived as weakness in that industry. Right. And then, later in my career, when I was kind of checked out, I was just be kind of like, no, I'm not going to do this, or, you know, I'm not doing
it. And that worked out better for you?
I got raises. Wow. I got promoted. It was like, wow, the less I pretend I give a shit about anything, the more people think that I have something important to say, which is really sick.
But doesn't that translate a little bit into a lot of careers, including comedy?
Of course. Well, I think what is parallel between the two of them is that they're extreme career paths. Like, very few people make it to the top tiers.
Or at least even a living.
Yeah, even to making a living. And so it's very high risk.
You got real ego there, like going, yeah. Like, I will take both.
I will be the queen. Well, the thing is, like, fashion, you have to, it's like any other creative career, because you have to kill yourself in order to be successful. And I mean, almost kill yourself. Like, everyone works constantly. They're always on their phones. You know, there's never like a moment to take a break, or else the idea is that someone else will take your spot. And that's not uncommon in comedy either. You have to dedicate your whole life to it. So if you, like, I sort of hit this crossroad with fashion where I started doing comedy and I thought like, oh, this is something that I love so much more. You know, and I was also like 19 when I wanted to work in fashion. I wasn't really fully an adult. And so once I realized that I didn't love it to that level, then like, why would I work so hard?
Because you have to, in both careers, you have to love it so much.
To take the shit that it gives you. Both of them are, it's endless. I mean, this is a dramatic word, but it's endlessly being degraded and humiliated. And
you seem to love that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like an accident that I'm like, oh, these careers are both extreme and filled with psychotic people and make you work yourself till you almost die. Like, I understand.
Which one's more your dad?
Probably fashion.
Is it rude that in fashion houses, they don't have padding like a gym on all the floors? They know what's happening. It'd be too obvious, right? Newspapers would find out.
Yeah. I mean, they don't acknowledge that. Lots of interns have sued fashion houses because they work them throughout the night and stuff like that. Like, you know.
Right.
And comedians never bothered to sue anybody, really.
Because we don't respect ourselves.
Yeah, but you really literally get paid in drink tickets.
Yeah.
If you're getting paid at all.
One second. I want to tell everybody about Quip. Q-U-I-P. It's the toothbrush I use. Hemda uses it. It's electric, but not big and bulky like a regular electric one when you think electric, right?
Yeah, not as expensive either. It was so affordable that I have one at home. And I also have one when I stay at my brother's family's place. It's an electric toothbrush that doesn't take up the amount of room that the regular one does. And it's just, it actually is the size of a regular toothbrush. So here's what I like actually the most in it. Mm-hmm. I know that I'm brushing my teeth for 2 minutes because it indicates it every 30 seconds. So I know to do 30 seconds on the top right, 30 seconds on the top left, bottom right, bottom left, obviously. And then when it's done, it's this sense of satisfaction. Actually, I told my friend Aldo about it, and he recently texted me. He said, dude, I came in for my 6-month dental cleaning. It took less than 15 minutes on the actual cleaning. That goddamn Quip really works.
That's right. It's great. You're going to love it too. Over 1 million happy, healthy mouths do. Quip starts at just $25.
That's the craziest part.
Yeah. And if you go to getquip.com/MOL for my opening line, /MOL, right now, you can get your first refill pack for free. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/MOL.
Do you remember the first time you went up on stage?
Yes, I do. Yes. It was at the Creek in the Cave of New York City. And I went there.
An open mic, I assume.
Oh, no, no, I was booked.
Who knows? You just go on stage.
The story that you tell about going to a club and just being like, I'll go up next is so crazy to me. Because I was nervous to go to an open mic that I knew I was allowed to do comedy. I'd gone there many times. I actually had an old producer of the show, Danny Hatch, come with me. Because I was like, I need a person to faint on after I do this.
Hold my ginger ale.
Yeah. Well, no, I was drunk as fuck.
Oh, so you were drunk on stage the first time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was drunk for probably the first maybe 6 months of doing comedy. I would get pretty intoxicated before I went on stage because I thought it made me perform better, which is very funny.
Which is funny because you don't have something to compare it to. Also.
No, I just didn't have the confidence.
Right.
And you remember it still?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was...
When it's embarrassing, it doesn't matter if you blacked out.
Sure, sure. I even remembered it through a blackout. It was the Creek in the Cave. I knew that place. That place had a reputation of being like the best. It was the intimidating place to go because the people who were performing there at that time were people who are now like very famous. It's kind of like known as this sort of breeding ground and like... you know, it's harder to do well there. So if you do well there in front of these people, it means more. Mm-hmm. There's a really high expectation. And like the bar is higher to do well there.
That's a lot of pressure for just an open mic. You should be able to bomb.
Yes. Yeah. And it's also very hard to start in New York because these good people see you bomb. And when someone sees you bomb, I try not to judge an open micer really, especially if they're early, because it's like you're so bad for so long. But some people never forget that version of you.
Yeah.
These open mics are tough, too. I've seen Andrea at one, and she's a total pro. And she'll take it like you paid money to see her. But I see the audience filled with, for the majority of the time, other comedians.
Yeah.
And either deliberately or subconsciously, they want to do better than you, so they're treating you like a piece of shit. And I think it's pretty obvious that they're not just working on their act as much as they want you to see their feet are up on the chair in front of them.
Sure.
They want you to see their coat is still on, or they're being a little too loud asking a friend to get them a drink.
But I think they're also going through what Andrea was describing earlier. They're probably getting too drunk because they're nervous. They're probably trying to act as if because... otherwise, you're drowning.
What a perfect Keith and Hemda reaction to that. Keith was like, they're pieces of shit, and I know it. And Hemda's like, here's their emotional reason for being a piece of shit.
We all have issues. Yeah, Hemda cares why. I don't. It's still
both reasons are true.
Right.
And it's also like, if you break that comic who's been listening to comedy for like 5 hours today probably and has done a total of maybe 4 minutes, if they're lucky.
If you make them laugh.
If you make them laugh, it's a big accomplishment. So I went there and my first joke was...
How much time did you have?
I think maybe 2 or 3 minutes.
Oof, so fast. Okay.
Very confident. I was very confident out the gate. Okay. I don't know why, but I maybe just the was. Drink. Yeah, the drink, but also like I thought because I knew comedy that that I would just be a natural, and I also have always
been were the funny friend, right?
Yeah, funny friend. I had history in performance. Like I did musical theater, did theater. I knew how to be on stage and speak publicly. But the
worst case scenario, I do a little Oklahoma.
Yeah, I really and I rely a lot on charisma even now. Like it's something that I have a strength in. But when you have literally nothing to back it up, it's so like it becomes immediate. The minute you say your joke and no one is reacting, you're like, oh my God.
But you did have a joke planned.
Well, yeah. So the joke was, there was this girl, and you know what? To be honest, I still stand by this joke a little bit. So there was this girl who I went to college with. She went on an exchange program, and she got blackout drunk, and she blew a homeless guy in the bathroom.
Oh, shit.
And
what was her name, Andrew?
That
wasn't Andrea?
It wasn't me. No, no. There was this girl I knew, this drunk whore.
I'm telling a story for a friend.
Schmandria Schmalen. No, but the punchline, and we're going to generously call this a punchline, was like, you guys all think she's a fucking whore. I think she's a hero. I mean, people in New York, they won't even give change to homeless people, but she's out there blowing them. Hallelujah.
And do you take a bow? Like, do you wait for the applause?
All but that. I was like, this is such a hot take.
You and go to also, high five.
Yeah, like, this, she's sucking off homeless guys like Mother Teresa, dick sucking, boo dice. I was very Keith Malley. I was very bravado and loud, but it's like there was no.
That makes it worse, doesn't it?
Oh, it's like, God.
And
yeah.
Here's my punchline.
Oh, my God. There was this one. This was not the first time, but it was very early on. And I had this joke. Again, so much bravado. No writing, timing, no. A lot of comedians have, when they start, they
take on a voice.
Way too much explanation early. They don't know how to trim the fat. So it's basically just a premise explained over and over again. And people are like, yeah, I know, but it's not. It's still not funny.
She went to school with me. She was taking basic classes.
Yeah, yeah. Very much that. Because you think it's funny in your head. And you're funny is like the most... boiled down essence of it is where you're going to get funny. But when you don't know how to do that, you're just grasping all around it, trying to get some reaction. So I had this joke that was like, you know how they call ugly people dogs?
Oh, no, not this one. Andrea.
And they call...
We're not making her say
and
this.
And they call fat people pigs. I've come up with a word, audience, here, for an ugly fat person. A dog pig. And then I was like, hello. Hello. I'm a beautiful woman saying this. What's unlikable about this?
That's the thing, is like she's calling people dog pig. And I don't know if you're not realizing that you are the most beautiful person in the room.
Oh, yeah. And I think
you're literally talking to homeless people.
Yeah. And I'm like, you fucking pigs. Ha.
But then you double down on this. What happens with Andrea, and tell me if this is wrong, when it's so bad, you're like, oh, now it's so bad that it's making me laugh.
Because this is so bad. I am the worst. Everyone hates me. This is hilarious. I don't know. It's like watching bad improv. It's like when a performance is going so bad, it's such a funny sight. It's such a
that
gross...
You get that from Keith, because I am not comfortable with that.
Oh, I love it. Even when it's happening to me, I think it's funny. Like, I hate it, but I'm like, God, this is going to be funny later.
I wish
what
I could
a
see
moron.
Me.
Yeah. See me just desperately trying to... But you get it? It's because pigs. And I remember I looked at a fat comedian who was in the audience, and then I... Because you don't... There's so many things that go into a joke being well-received, and one of it is if you are an attractive person... Talking down to people who are less attractive is a horrible look, but you don't understand like how you're viewed by others. You just think like it's a funny thing I'm saying, and it's
right. And we're all pigs, and we're all like, disgusting.
You know that I have no ill will, but that's not. You don't understand. They don't know that.
Yeah.
And the only information you're giving them now is that. I mean, that's also a horrible joke. Yeah. But
now at the end of that, are you like, hey, maybe I don't do this. Maybe I keep doing this.
I had so much fun.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I had so much fun
Did you hear what you said?
Sure.
Let me play this back. Hold on.
This girl's sucking off homeless guys. And I'm like, hell yeah, sister. I'll get the balls, you get the shaft. Am I right? Nobody? Okay.
Have you heard sober? Have you heard? You've been sober how long? In general, even with the slipper too.
6 years, 7 years maybe.
Okay, but you did stand up drunk.
Yes, yeah. For the first maybe, I guess it's been less than 6 years, but I think for the first half a year at least, I was belligerently drunk.
Have you heard stand up from that time?
Yes.
And?
So bad.
Okay.
And that was actually kind
of— Were you slurring?
Yes.
Yeah.
There was, oh my
God. Do an impersonation
of you. My friend took a video of it. So the mic stand had a cup holder in it. And I remember thinking that was fucking amazing. And I was like, I'm going to go up and do a fucking riff. So I bought two beers and I kept putting one beer in the mic stand and being like, I can put this in the mic stand. I'll hold it with the other one. And then I switch it. I put this in the mic stand. I'll hold it with the other one. And then I'm holding both and I'm like, who has another thing to put on the mic stand? And that's like crowd work. That's early crowd work.
You like maybe you could have been subtle and just did it and they'd be like, oh, I see what I'm seeing. You're clear.
I was like,
you see what the fuck I'm doing?
Yeah, I asked my friend to tape me doing stand-up and I was going to like submit it. The delusion in the early years. You need the delusion to keep going because you're so bad. But I was like, please send me this tape. And my friend kept being like, oh, there's something
wrong.
Weird. It's really hard. And like, and as a good friend.
He keeps breaking his phone.
Yeah.
I dropped it in water again.
Hello? I can't. And this was a civilian friend who like laughed and would come out to my bad shows and be supportive. And then I saw the footage and I was like, you are, because I was so drunk. I'm like, you're missing all the cues. Like when you're in it and you're drunk, you're not understand. I also didn't understand how to read audience members. But I didn't understand how to read audience members. I was also drunk. So like someone would say something, I'd be like, what do you fucking say? You know what I mean? Like they would be talking to a waiter or something and I was misunderstanding.
Yeah, I'll take, can I see a dessert menu? What's that?
Yeah. I would get like, I was like an edgelord. I used to like get in people's faces because I talk to audience members now. I do a fair bit of crowd work, but
What's an edgelord? Just somebody's in somebody's face?
Yeah, just like trying to push it just to seem interesting, you know, but I didn't have anything interesting to say or I wasn't able to
What was properly. It like watching that tape?
Oh, it was horrible.
But was it also funny?
Yeah, of course. If I saw it now, I'm all red. That's a huge part of it too, is that I thought I looked normal. I was like red and sweaty and like, you know how drunk people look swollen all the time? And then I kept trying to put it into the mic cup holder and then missing sometimes, like, this is not fucking cup holder. And then I would ding off of it and then like, I dickhead. It was, I didn't get sober directly after that. I mean, it took a little longer. It's crazy that I watched that.
Oh, so you watched it while you were still drinking?
I watched it while I was still drinking and it was one of the things along the way where I was like, I mean, it was like, there are many things, but one, I saw drunk comics who don't deal with their alcoholism, I saw like what they start to look like down the road. Like you can kind of, it's kind of passable in the 20s. In the 30s, it starts to become more obvious. In the 40s, it's really kind of rough looking. And I was like, I drink at the same pace and like with the same style, quote unquote, as these people. And that looks horrible. And then there was also—
What's the pacing? What does it look like when you're drinking?
Like, probably, I mean, I would drink like three before I got on stage beers. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, there's like the late night hang. So I would probably have anywhere between like seven more or eight more. It depended on
with how, shots and stuff, or
probably, yeah. Or
you have
or,
a high tolerance.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm a
you're
big also person.
6 foot.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I do have a really high tolerance.
Okay, hold on. You're not 6 feet wide.
Yeah. You're a beer fridge. Yeah. So
as I said that, I'm like, yeah, that doesn't matter.
No. Comedy is if you have addictive problems or psychological problems.
They support that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. If you don't pull yourself out of that, it will allow you to really indulge in it because there's a lot of people with problems who are
it actually also
to.
Like you said, the late night hang, it feels like that's where people get their work from, their friends from. So it's difficult to be like, this isn't actually helping me.
Sure.
It's hard to see.
You need like rules for yourself.
So when do you think you got, like, when was the moment that it's like, okay, I'm doing this now?
There are a few. I think I booked an all female show at the Village Underground.
I was part of that.
I know, called Feminasty.
Mm-hmm. Guys could watch. I was there too.
I know. Yeah. And
that was exciting.
I booked a lineup with people who were like way ahead of me. Like there was Bonnie McFarlane and Corinne Fisher, Justy Dodge, Karen Feehan. There were people who were like established already. And I put myself amongst them. Like I didn't think that I was at their level, but I was like, I want to book this really big show so I can get a tape and also like kind of try to do 10 minutes in front of like a big crowd. And it was packed and it was like a really successful show. And I remember crushing what I viewed as like crushing at that time. And I remember afterwards, Bonnie McFarlane said something really nice about me to you. And I was like, whoa, if this like pro is impressed by me and this is at a club and I'm amongst people who are working comics and my peers.
And it was like, an iconic club too.
Yeah. I was like, oh, like part of me was like, if she says it, it's not a trick. You know, it's like everyone, so many people have imposter syndrome. And I think like putting myself in that professional setting and striving was really like, wow, okay. Like I'm not making money off of this right now. And I'm not a professional comic yet, but I can play around with like the big dogs. So there must be something here.
That's cool.
I was going to say going on 6 years and you're humble about how things are going, but you feel like, all right, I'm getting a grasp on this. Every so often, because you do so many shows, there'll be something weird that happens. You're at a show and surprise, as you're on stage, the guy that booked it decides it's a heckler show, only he heckles. You didn't know. The audience didn't know.
Yeah.
Do you have these moments where like, fuck this whole thing, this is dumb?
Oh, like every week.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think the moments of why am I doing this is like, and me and Hannah Moon were talking about this. We go on the road a lot together and we treat everything with such professionalism. Like I'm taking this seriously. And then when you walk into like, let's say in LA, a place that was formerly a karate dojo and there's no one in the audience and the owner of the club makes you perform for one another, you're like, what? I just spent money to get here. I came here prepared to perform. I'm not getting paid, which sucks, but it's something.
It's a booked show.
Yeah, it's a booked show. So, and then.
And you're trying to establish yourself in LA.
Yeah, you're like, what am I doing? Like, I feel like a loser because this situation is so loserish. Like, why are you forcing us to do this? I'm not improving. Like, in the beginning, I think you take all the shows and you take the shit ones and the crazy ones because you need to be good at being on stage and you need to learn how to handle a host who heckles you or things that come out of nowhere because it happens all the time in comedy. But then you hit a certain level and when you get thrown into one of these, you're like, I thought I was done doing my time with this crazy bullshit. But the thing that you don't realize is that you're never done doing your time with crazy bullshit because then you'll see someone who has a Comedy Central special walk in and be doing the same type of thing. So,
which is not good. Like, it's
no,
that's not how careers should work, but it's very difficult to get out of the system. Although I think podcasting is helping that system get better.
Sure.
Yeah.
But there's also I also feel like there's so many comedians now. It feels like we're in a boom of comedy since, you know, our world's so insane. Anytime like world or politics are bad, I think there's more comedians because it's people like publicly expressing a reaction to the wild place that we currently live.
It would be funny. Everything changes for the better and people go home. I'm good.
Yeah, I think comedy, people need comedy in bad times the most. I wonder if there's like a sociological study that correlates with that.
You already have plenty of career.
Sure.
But I also think it's cool that you take kind of wacky shows. I think Keith was mentioning it earlier, but you did a naked roast.
Oh my God.
You did a high show.
Yeah. The naked roast was the worst bomb that I've ever experienced in my life.
Because you were naked or?
A couple things.
And you're fully naked, not like Janet Jackson on the cover of Rolling Stones naked.
No, fucking pussy out, baby. Poon to the wind.
Right. Do you try to cover it with a little hair? Like, this week I'm growing out my hair.
I think I did a landing strip. I think I was like, I want to look like cool. Right. I don't know why.
A lightning bolt.
Yeah. The naked roast was, I do this a lot, is if something seems challenging or crazy, I run straight for it, which I think is a good quality in a lot of ways, and also how I end up, you know, performing in insane places. But it's like this confidence and this delusion.
Do you feel comfortable naked?
I thought I did, but I didn't anticipate a lot. I didn't plan well for the naked roast. I thought I was just like, I'm going to run on charisma, which is the story of my life. And I didn't write as much as you should. Roasts are known for writing exclusively. Like, you have to be able to deliver the joke well, but it's more about the writing than anything else. And I was like, I'm just going to have.
Especially because you were up against somebody that you knew well.
Sure.
So you kind of were like, well, I know how to diss this guy.
I was up against Billy Procida and I was like, I'm going to take him out. He can't do stand up. He's an idiot. I'm going to fucking kill.
But I was with him once and he was too drunk to get hard.
Yeah.
What's he going to look like on stage in the cold?
I mean, regularly we just, when Billy Procida is in the Keith and the Girls studios, we're just like, roast, 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 roast.
Oh, yeah.
So you think it's just going to kind of come out.
Well, because when you're doing a roast, you have to remember that the audience doesn't know you or the other person. So if you're not famous, you need to like pick on physical things usually, because that's the easiest thing for them to understand.
But you guys
quickly.
Really will? You'll say like a small prick? Like, you'll mention physical things?
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's the best thing to do at a roast, because that's the thing that the audience immediately knows. The more you have to explain a joke in a roast, the worse it's going to go.
But as if you comedians didn't have low enough self-esteem in general.
Yeah.
Let's go with your tits.
Absolutely.
Did he go for your tits?
Yes.
What'd he say?
He said I had small tits. He wasn't great either. Probably one of the worst moments. I was bombing. I called him a slur, a gay slur, because I was just freaking out. Like,
how did you start off?
I went out, and also I didn't take into account how nervous I would be being naked. So as soon as I was naked, I was like, oh, I am way more nervous than I thought I would be, which there goes your charisma that you were going to coast on.
Like, even backstage?
Yes, standing naked with a group of guys backstage.
See, I never told you this. When I practice my stand-up show at home once a year, I do it naked just in case.
Good.
God forbid.
Good. Put yourself, it's like running with weights. It really it makes you way more self-conscious. And also, the dais was Ari Shaffir, Mike Lawrence, and this guy named Bronson, who was from LA. I didn't know him that well, but
Charles Bronson.
Yeah. but those are all like those two guys, Ari Shaffir and Mike Lawrence. Those are both like huge deals.
Very established, also very quick and very smart.
Mean too. Yeah. Both very mean. They're allowed
they're
to.
They're good at being mean.
Yeah, that's like their brand. Yeah. Especially Mike Lawrence. Like, yes. Mike Lawrence was known in the scene then for just like eviscerating people.
And he ended up winning the Comedy Central roast.
Yes.
Yeah, he's no joke.
No.
I mean, he's a lot of jokes. So you're backstage with a bunch of guys.
Yeah.
Naked.
Naked.
Were they commenting? Is there a vibe back there?
Not really. There's a lot of camaraderie, actually, more than you would think. You know, everyone's sneaking a peek for sure.
Yeah, I guess you have to. Yeah.
Everybody's dropping things.
Yeah. <you know? laughs> The women were Aaliyah Janine and Caitlin Bailey. So those are two women that are pretty comfortable being.
Wait, Aaliyah Janine, who does porn?
Yes.
So she's going to be fine. Mm-hmm. And who else?
Caitlin Bailey.
Also
yes.
Was a just sex worker.
Me, a bunch of sex workers and guys who can't do comedy all in the back room. And then shit. Ari Shaffir. It just was like.
And Ari's very comfortable with everything.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just was like, oh my God, I am not prepared for this. Like, I'm not prepared for how I feel right now. I'm not prepared. It was also packed, like so packed.
So what do you think when you're there? Do you pretend to die?
I wish. I kept layering on the confidence, but my voice was shaking. I also didn't have my jokes fully memorized. So I was like stumbling over words. And
what was the joke?
I think I just called Billy a pussy the whole time. I couldn't even tell you one joke. It was that bad. It was my first roast. I was like, how about it was my first roast? Mm-hmm. I do it naked in front of all of my peers and famous people. and I barely write. And the thing is, I don't regret that because it taught me the importance of being prepared. Like, it was,
yeah, like you think it's a fun thing, like, oh, there's a naked roast, there's a bunch of like shit birds, and it's
goofy. Yeah, yeah, but people can get real exposure from roasts. And like, you should, if you have a homework show, do the homework. But I remember like one of the worst moments, I was bombing. This was the sound effects. So I'd be like, Billy's a pussy. And it would be like, burr, burr. And then all the like Legion of Skanks fans, I'll be like, fuck you, bitch. And it was just like, oh my God. Uh-huh. I almost like left my body. And this has happened to me a few times when it's just so high stakes and your ego just kind of dies. Cause it's like, I can't be in this person's body right now where they have all of their worst nightmares happen in real time. And then Billy had a joke. Billy was so bad too, but he beat me, which is crazy. Billy leaned over and he was like, Andrea's pussy sounds like Sam Kinison. And then he screamed into my vagina. So he bent down and like Billy Procida is screaming directly into my vagina in front of hundreds of people. And no one's really laughing at him either. So now
it doesn't make any sense.
It makes no one knows that I scream a lot. Like, that's the thing. We were both inexperienced. It's like, these audiences don't know you. So write things that are simple and easy to understand. And I'm like, Billy has a podcast called The Manor and he's rambly.
What
and
did
I'm
you
naked.
Afterwards? Did you run away?
I
drank again.
No, I can't believe I didn't relapse. I went out. Side to meet some friends, and like everyone, when you bomb that badly, other comics like don't want to look you in the eye because they, I think it's a combo of things. Like, one, they don't know what to say to you because it's like everyone knows what just happened. They don't want to be like, oh dude, you bombed out there.
And they don't want to be like, no, you were great.
Yeah, because feels weird. Yeah, and they don't, it's like they don't want
to. They're probably doing you the favor, they think,
but then no one will look at you. Right. So it's like, oh, I already feel like the biggest loser of all time. And now everyone's being like, excuse me, don't want to touch you because you have a disease called untalented. And why did you do this?
I'd pass you and go, I just got here.
Yeah, I would love that.
You're like, I saw you in the front row jacking off. No.
They also called me the Legion of Skanks logo for that particular festival was like a black haired kind of heavy metal looking chick. And they were like, you're like the logo for the festival, but older. And like, I had never gotten, I think I was maybe like 20, 26, 27 or something like that. And I'd never gotten a like, you're old joke before. And I was like, oh, am I? Like, it was just another layer of insecurity that I didn't even know I could feel.
Did you question your comedy career?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Because how long did it take you to get on stage?
As soon as I put on clothes.
Sure. Probably a few days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, did you cry?
Yes.
Yeah.
Later I cried. I was in shock. I was mostly in shock about like how I could have thought it would have gone so well and how completely the opposite it went from what I thought. I guess I had a mentor and a friend who comforted me. I went to a diner with Emily Lubin and my friend Shaq Stanley. And Shaq Stanley had been mentoring me a little bit from that time. And he just said, like, use the pain, you know? And he was like, remember how painful it was. And like, next time you don't want to finish a joke or you're being lazy or like you think something's not a big deal, like, remember how painful that was and go the extra mile so that you never feel this way again. And so that's the only like good thing that you can take out of an experience like that. It was very, because I wasn't a good writer at that time. And like, I like I said, I have a lot of stage presence, but writing is not my strong suit. And so it was like,
and writing would more easily make you coast than charisma.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because you can be flat, and if your jokes are funny, you won't have to add anything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's so I really was like, you need to work on your writing. Do not rely on your charisma, because when you rely on your charisma and you're not prepared, something like this happens.
Wait, I don't mean to interrupt everything, but I have not been sleeping well.
What are you, an idiot? Get a Purple mattress, Hemda. Purple mattresses.
Oh, I've heard of this.
It's the name of the company, Purple. The founders of Purple are two brothers, They've developed cushioning technology for 30 years, medical beds, wheelchairs, things like this. And they said, hey, how about we work for ourselves? And in 2016, they decided to use their patented comfort technology to create Purple.
Oh, like a mattress with science behind it.
No joke. They call themselves the world's most scientific mattress.
I believe in science.
Yes. The Purple mattress, yeah, it's going to feel different than anything you've ever experienced because it uses brand new material that was developed by an actual rocket scientist.
I bet they know that the world is round because they just know all kinds of science things.
What? They know that it's better than memory foam, which people like, right? It's not what you're used to. It's not what you're used to.
I'm going to check this out.
It's unique. It's breathable.
Ugh, I love breathing.
Sleep cool. Okay? How about this? A 100-night risk-free trial. If you think I'm just blowing smoke up your pipe. I'm not.
That's helpful.
If you're not fully satisfied, you can return your mattress for a full refund after 100 nights.
Yeah, and that's it's like really nerve-wracking to pick a mattress. So if you know, yeah, you could just kind of have no hassle if you're not into it, that's so helpful.
Backed by a 10-year warranty. So even after that,
wow,
they give you a break. Free shipping and returns. No tricks. I hate tricks.
Mattresses are heavy.
Yeah. Well, you're going to love Purple. Right now, you can get a free Purple pillow, also made by scientists, with the purchase of a mattress. That's in addition to the great free gifts that they're offering site-wide. You go to their website, you'll see. Here's what you can do. Text opening, O-P-E-N-I-N-G.
Like for my opening line?
Yeah, to 84888.
84888.
The only way to get this free pillow.
Text opening.
Mm-hmm.
To 84888.
Yes.
Okay.
Opening to 84888. Message and data rates may apply. You know how the world works.
Come on.
Enjoy.
Opening 84888. So what were your other, like, okay, I'm doing better. I should continue the milestones that kept you going that were positive.
I think I did, the first time I performed at Caroline's, I had a show there, a comic who used to come to my open mic who liked me worked there and he did a produced show and was packed out and everyone was bombing like really badly.
Did that scare you?
Oh yeah. If you're in a show and everyone's bombing,
you just think like it's over.
Yeah. Well, the crowd's not great or the comics are not giving them what they're looking for. Like there's lots
of- But then
of,
what the fuck is it?
Right. And then- and
I, you only find out when you get on stage.
Sure. But yeah, you can also like, usually when everyone's bombing, you should do crowd work a little bit to try to feel out the crowd because maybe this crowd wants it to be about them. That's the best way to remedy. If you're getting a crowd that has no reaction, kind of like try to reach out to them. But it also was comics who were then sort of at my level. Like we were amateurs in a way and now we're in a club and these are paying audiences and they kind of expect more. And it was like we were not delivering what they expected. And then I went last and just crushed. Like it was I don't even, you know, not to brag, but
that's what happened.
It was incredible. And like the staff at the club came up to me and were like, where do you perform? Like we've never seen you before. And there was even like a manager in the audience, weirdly enough, and was like, here's my card or whatever.
Did you cry that night?
Oh yeah, with happiness, with pure joy. Yeah. And again, I remember being like, okay, not every night in comedy is going to be like this, but like if you're in an institute, like a place like Caroline's, it has like big history and has standards and these people paid and I crushed again after like a bunch of people bombing, then okay, then I'm like, I am feeling closer to being like, because that's, you know, being a paid comic and like performing at clubs is, it's not the end all be all, but it's one of the indicators that you are worth being booked and being paid to do this and audiences like you enough to come out for you, you know?
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
Other than drinking, what would you tell yourself 6 years ago personally? Mm. What do you wish you knew about comedy?
A few things. Firstly, don't fuck other comics.
Okay.
That's hard though.
Why is that bad?
In the beginning.
I mean, never mind. You just have to see that person again, but is it bad otherwise?
It's bad in the beginning because you are vulnerable. You have the least amount of power in like comedy is like any industry. There are people who are on the hierarchy who've been there longer than you. Right. So it's going to fuck with your... So say you sleep with a comic who's higher up than you or someone who's maybe volatile. That person's then in your workspace. So...
Most likely you're not going to pick the right person because of the people who do go for open micers, if they are in a different space,
yeah,
are the volatile or the
predatory.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they end up like doing you. You think you're like, oh, well, I'm stepping up and sure. This person thinks I'm funny, so I'm funnier. But really, they are destroying your career.
Do you see that a lot? A person established a little bit and they're going for the open micer. And you can see, look, I don't want to say nothing to anybody, but you're not finding that person necessarily their brain's attractive.
It's like giving candy to a baby. It's really fucked up. I've seen that a lot. Like people our age, they're in their 40s and they're going for the 23-year-old new comic. And it's not just that they're 23, because a 23-year-old can handle a lot. Like mm-hmm. they are in the world, but you see they're new in this career, so their novelty is just bouncing terribly off this person. It's like, what are you interested in?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I start like, and what's funny is, so when I was 23, I started being around comics too, and the people that I dated are now still dating 23-year-olds, yeah. And it's just hard to look them in the face.
Well, it's also like, I took my worth as a comedian based off of what these guys were saying to me, and a lot of them would be like, you're just an open mic. Like they would like roast me in a way that comics roast. I mean, these guys were assholes, but like that is kind of part of the culture. But it's like, well, you're my sexual partner and you're also so my superior that I'm taking what you're saying as truth because you do know better than me. And I also like, I once made out with a guy who was dating a club owner and I didn't know that. He didn't tell me. I mean, he's at fault there. But then the club owner sees when you're like the messy chick that like hooks up a lot, people are like, she's not professional. She's going to cause some sort of scene. Like, and even though these other people who are higher up on the food chain are participating in it with you, people don't blink an eye at them. So it kind of, they can sully your reputation. And I think it like, it definitely sullied my reputation a little bit. I think I always was like trying to be a decent person, but I would have probably moved forward faster, or I would have been taken more seriously. You know, it's hard to undo first impressions.
Would you catch insecure comics who have been doing it for a while, trying to put you down to make themselves feel better so that you feel bad liking them more?
Yeah. Well, I recognize that now, but like that's another thing is like another piece of advice would be if someone is going out of their way to put you down, don't listen to that person, because people who are secure and good at what they do don't need to go out of their way to bully other comics. Like I said, there's hazing and stuff, and that's like there's regular kind of joking around amongst friends. That's the language of comedians. But the people who put me down, and there are other female comics who bullied me too, I see them now and they're kind of in the same place. And I'm like, oh, that's what that was. So don't, as much as you want to take the word from your superiors and people who have been around for a while, take it with a grain of salt if there's someone who constantly goes out of their way to make you feel bad, because there's something wrong with that person. They're not respected by their peers. You can almost always guarantee that.
When you first started, did you have to watch who you were imitating? Because you can't help yourself. You're brand new. You're here to prove. Who did you watch more growing up? Fashion people or comedians?
Probably comedians. I just liked expressing myself with clothing. I wasn't obsessed in the way that I was obsessed with comedy. Like comedy was very important in my household. My older brother, who introduced me to you guys, gave me like the Chappelle DVD set when I was a young girl. I watched a lot of, oh my God, the red, these are like Canadian references, but Tom Green, I'm sure you guys know him. And like,
he made a fool of himself here. Yes.
Sure. Sure. Don't you talk about our idol that way.
You guys have Justin. That's fine.
Yeah.
And Trudeau, not the other one.
Yes.
You have the other one too. I'm sorry.
It's okay. There's a lot of great, like Mike Myers and Jim Carrey. Like I loved comedy. Always. So
is it interesting that all the fashion people now are either dying from, you know, health or suicide, and all the comedians of that generation, they're in jail.
Yes. But yeah, I don't, and I always loved, I mean, I remember when I saw Superbad too, even though that's within like a recent time, I was like, that's the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life. Like, I can't even believe how funny this is. And that was always like how I felt about it. I was like, I love funny things. I want to create funny things. I want to know how it's done. I was always obsessed with it. So, you know.
Did you sound like Chappelle when you first got on stage?
No, I sounded like Keith Malley, actually. All right. I sounded a lot like Keith Malley.
I could still hear him a little bit in you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I listened to both of you guys for so long. You definitely were a huge influence on me, both in podcasting but in stand-up. And then like Dice via Keith Malley, because
Keith was influenced by Dice and created a new character.
Sure.
And then you took both of those and then mm-hmm. created a new character.
Right. Yeah. What will my protégés be? Be like 1/10 Dice. Like I'm one.
A copy of a copy. Uh-huh. Who else? Like a Louis C.K. maybe? Because
yeah.
Yeah, that's why you did that naked show, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just wanted to show everyone my lady prick. Yeah, I mean, everyone, I would say every comedian was imitating Louis C.K. within my class of people. Not just like, not his cadence, but he kind of like, I feel like there's sort of like breaks in comedy. So, or I guess breaking down of like fakeness is, I don't know if that's the word, but like Lenny Bruce was the first person who was like swearing and stuff like that.
Like you took down a wall.
Yeah. And Louis took down a wall in terms of
being so personal,
extremely personal,
and shitting on his kids for a laugh.
Yeah. Really like talking about race in a way that was really interesting. I remember the first time I saw his bit about being white, he was saying like being white is clearly better. Not that I think white people are better, but being white is clearly better. I remember being like, wow, I've never heard anyone just like out mm-hmm. and say that. Now we're used to that level of honesty, but then it was like, this is blowing my mind. So I think and also you guys have always been very honest about your lives. So I think Louis and you guys and I also like, I would study comedians and try to see, because you
definitely know your history.
Well, yeah, yeah. I feel like, I mean, you don't have to, but I think it's important if you go into an art form to kind of learn about it, its history. And so I would be like every week study a few comedians and see how they write their jokes, what methodologies they use to deliver their material, how they move on stage, like what's an absurdist comic look like? Mm-hmm. What does, you know, just a, like a Jerry Seinfeld type thing, who's an observational.
Well, you definitely do your homework and then put it out. Like you said, when there's homework to be done, do it. I think you definitely took that to heart. And, I always describe you like if somebody's, you know, talking about him like, oh, you don't know her. She's going to be famous. You need to start paying attention.
Very sweet of you.
And they start writing your name down. I'm like, yeah, like don't fuck around. That's I really truly believe that. I think you will be like Amy Schumer, Sarah Silverman.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
Lovely.
I remember taping your first podcast and I was like, wow. Like, honestly, I was like, oh, okay, I'm glad they're doing this because you guys, and this is the Hot Mess Comedy Hour, you guys have to subscribe to it.
Thank you.
You guys really knew what was fun, what was important. You kept it moving. And for a first time podcaster who like you were starting to do it once a week, I was so impressed. You definitely need to be on mic and your expression is like just growing. And I love that we were there like in the beginning.
Thank
because
you,
I really, this is like so fun watching you develop and being like one of my favorite comics of all time.
Oh,
so it's a very, very big deal. And this EP it made me so proud. Aww. And it was so special that we were in the audience and that, yeah, me too, because it's a big deal because not a lot of people stick to it. And instead of, you know, you could quit, that's not a bad thing, but to learn constantly and to like develop not only your sense of humor, but your understanding of yourself in order to keep being funny and to keep like, to keep things in perspective is very difficult. You're in a different country, you're a woman in a man's world, and you don't let any of that get to you except in the good way. So I'm a huge admirer, and I think you guys should follow her everywhere she goes and your Instagram, all of it is just, it is history, I think. And I think that
herstory, like, yes, baby.
Yes, yes. So all of that is a very big deal. And it's very cool that you're part of like the Keith and the Girl world as our producer and just like in our lives. Like, I love when you come over at 2 a.m. like a crazy person. It's just been really fun watching you.
A fan called me a Keith and the Girl comedian. I was like, oh, hell yeah. I'm in the fucking
That's cool.
canon. I mean, you guys have been a part of so many like comedians' development. There's so many people who have come in and out of this like show who have then come along to be famous. And that was also really helpful for me starting knowing, like, I knew a lot more about what to look for than just a person starting. You know, I knew people. I kind of understood how open mics worked. So I had a little bit of a leg up in that way. But I'm a woman, so take that away. And put me back at ground zero.
Well, get this EP. Yes. What's the best way to get it?
It is, so if you prefer to buy things on streaming services, it's on Apple Music, iTunes, Spotify, all the tings. That's a Keith Malley influence mm-hmm. right there.
And also keithandthegirl.com/Andrea.
Yes.
We'll have the video and audio and other ways to get it, including iTunes. But really, look for Gonzo.
Yes.
That's the name of the album. You're going to love the cover. It's not safe for work. That's just a little heads up. So Gonzo by Andrea Allen.
You know, the cover actually kind of was inspired by you in a roundabout way. It turns out you guys are my biggest inspiration.
Kemda showed up to work once, covered in cum.
I know. Covered in cum. I said, Kemda.
I love it.
No, it was you guys introduced me to Andrew WK because you interviewed him and I was like fascinated by him for years.
Oh, I could see you marrying him.
Oh, I was in love. I was so yes. in love with him. Oh my God. Wanted to make weird freak babies
for
with him.
For sure.
But he has this album cover
where he got punched in the face.
Yeah, there's blood all over his face. And it's such a startling image. And
he's like, such a sweet, sweet person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's so much controversy around it. And I'm like, I think if you have an album cover, you should really fucking go for it, right? Especially if it's your first thing. Make it something that people are going to be like, whoa!
Yeah, and if your parents are going to be mad at you anyway, which sure, they are.
They're already so mad. Yeah. I don't talk to my dad. We're fine.
Everyone's fine. Everything's fine.
Yeah. So I basically emailed Mindy Tucker, who's an incredible photographer. And I was like, this picture, the
introduction,
but come. She was like,
she's like, that's why I study.
She took it so seriously. She was like, I'm learning about how they do liquids. I'm YouTubing.
She's amazing.
She had glue concoctions. Like, it was really.
And Hannah Boone was the one throwing the cum on your face during the.
She was spraying it out of a bottle.
Shout out to Hannah, also another comic that you should follow.
Shout out to Hannah for saving all that cum.
I know.
Something finally to do with it.
During that photo, I'm like, my eyes are so fucked up looking and I'm like screaming. And I truly am screaming because it's the glue going into my eyes.
Ugh.
We went for so long and
what
it was
is it
like,
made out of glue and milk
and then I had cream all over my face and then I poured milk all over my head
at one point. Do you think, honest to God, let's use real cum?
it would have been better.
I dated a lot of comics some time ago. Let's get them around.
Yeah,
do a bukkake,
you guys. It's called Gonzo by Andrea Allen. You gotta pick it up. It's out today, so you'll get it the first day that everyone has it, and trust me, this is part of history and you're gonna say that you had it when, so that's very important. If you like this show, if you like this episode, share it so that we could make more.
And now the closing theme song. What you just heard was my opening line. Please subscribe and tell your friends. Go to myopeningline.com.